Should I do the introduction?
Yeah.
Go for it. We're marvelous.
What are we calling it?
Marvelous Lunchtime.
Marvelous Lunchtime.
Or Marvelous Lunch?
I think a Marvelous Lunch Break, because it's like you can listen to it on your lunch break.
Yeah.
Take a break.
Marvelous
break.
Lunch Break.
We're like the Kit Kat of podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the first, maybe the last, marvelous lunch break. Is that what we decided to call it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I hope you're all having your lunch.
I'm the Kit Kat Chunky of a host, Dan Preston. And with me, I've got my two colleagues, now also podcast colleagues.
Yeah.
Even though I don't think we're going to make any money out of this.
No.
First up is Anna. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, obviously, I'm a bit of a podcast virgin. Don't know the important aspects, like the fact that no one can see me. So I'm coming to this podcast with a very good Marvel Universe movie knowledge, less so with the comics. I've always been a comic book fan, but it was more sort of the out there ones, Sandman, ElfQuest, Concrete. That's a great one. So once I started seeing the Marvel Universe movies, I got really excited about them, really delved into it. So I came late, but now I know my stuff.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
What's Concrete?
It's a Dark Horse comic. It's
nice.
Really good.
And also...
Martin, hello.
Martin Carter.
Yes.
Hello.
That's me. So I am probably the least knowledgeable about the MCU. No, not MCU, about Marvel and its history, I think. I came to the MCU quite late. There's some films in this retrospective that I still have yet to see. And I have a lot of questions about it. I also have quite a bad memory. So usually when I'm watching a Marvel film, I always have Wikipedia open to be like, who's that? Where's that context?
Are you the person who, half an hour into movie, is like, what's going on?
Yes, or, which is a terrible admission to make in the first podcast, fall asleep.
No!
Spoiler alert, I did fall asleep during Ant-Man and I have yet to see it all the way through.
Oh no.
So,
I've got a confession as well. I actually watched Iron Man over 2 days.
2 days?
I watched, so...
Not the first time. Like, ever.
Not the first time ever.
Yeah.
No, this time.
I reviewed,
when you
yeah.
were like, you need to go back and watch it. I started watching it pretty late at night and then decided I was quite tired. I picked it up again in the morning. So
is this podcast essentially us getting incredibly old and not being able to stay awake past 10 p.m?
I mean, when Iron Man first came, so Iron Man came out in 2008.
Yeah.
Let me just explain what the podcast purpose actually
yeah.
is first.
You haven't even introduced yourself yet.
I'm Dan Preston. I read comic books growing up. I don't care about consistency of comic books and movies. I just want to watch a good flick that's got some explosions and my favourite superheroes in. And I feel like I've been able to do that for the past 10 years since Iron Man came out, leading up to Avengers Infinity War, which comes out later on this year. And the reason we're doing this podcast is that on the countdown to Infinity Wars, we're going to watch one Marvel movie each week, completely spoiler including talking about them.
If you haven't seen films that came out in 2008 by now, it's their own fault.
I agree. But we've already said spoilers, so...
Yeah. So, I mean, free advertising for them.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
They'll be like, look at all those people that were drawn to the Marvel Universe.
Apart from the ones that we absolutely hate.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple in here which I wouldn't say hate, it's a strong word. Anyway, so the first movie up, we decided to go with the release order. Anna, I know you had some debate...
Chronological.
Why did you want to do chronological?
Well, I think just because, I mean, also I wanted to sort of rush myself to getting to Captain America. He's one of my faves. And I think there's definitely an argument to be made that that one should be seen first if you're going with a real kind of world-building type look. You've got Tony Stark's dad, you've got Howard Stark, you've got sort of that, this idea of already... this world has been built long before you've seen Iron Man. And I like that. However, in having watched Iron Man again, I think we've made the right choice about doing release order, because there's so much that Iron Man sets up, not just like story-wise, but it really, like, I feel, defined the visuals of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, both with like the way the tech looks, the way like the lighting is done in some ways, even across like different directors, and like the sounds too. So I think we've made the right call with having Iron Man as our first one.
And if this was chronological, so obviously you said the first Avenger, the Captain, that would go first, but would things change like substantially, or would it just be like every now and again there'd be a film that wouldn't be in release order?
Well, I think Marvel is releasing a list on like recommended viewing order, which I haven't seen yet, because I think Hulk would fall a bit differently as well. I can't quite remember now, but there is sort of like a timeline structure which I can look up and inform us about in the next one if need be.
I don't know if they've released it yet, because I remember the news was that, and I think a lot of it centers around the Avengers Tower being present in some movies and not in other movies.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm aware, I don't even know if it's released yet. So something could dramatically change that moves a movie forward or backwards in the timeline.
Mm, yeah.
But in general, I don't feel like it's going to matter. We all know roughly the sequence of events.
Mm.
And they were given to us in this order anyway.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a contentious point, really. Is, you know, if something does change massively because the tower's in the background or not, I don't think many people, and certainly I'm not going to be bothered whether Spider-Man happened before or after Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
And if people want to watch along with us, can we put this somewhere?
So we'll share this.
Yeah.
If we... So, by trade, you're a social media man.
So I should probably have the strategy nailed.
How should we share this on social media? Do we need a Twitter?
Hashtag.
No, I think your Instagram stories are pretty good.
Okay.
Countdown. So Dan's famous for rating things on his Instagram stories. We've had mince pies, we've had beer. What else did we have? Is that it?
That's it. Yeah, I'm famous for two things.
Two things.
But this is my first foray in movies.
So if we can follow along on Dan's Instagram stories, we'll pin it to the top of your Instagram stories.
Okay.
So we'll do handles and stuff at the end as well, so you can tell us how stupid we are.
I'm in at that. So let's crack on with Iron Man then.
Okay.
And Anna, you are absolutely bursting to tell us about your rewatch of the first Iron Man movie, which came out in 2008.
Yep.
So can we all just say what we were doing in 2008? Like, where were you life-wise?
I was graduating from university and just about to move to London. Do we remember what month this came out?
It came out on May the 2nd.
Okay, so that would have been my last year living in America full-time, been English resident ever since. So yeah, that was my last, I think, big cinematic moment in America before I moved over here. Yeah.
I had just finished my second year of university, so going into the summer before my third year.
Wow. And I was just going to university after my gap year. So I was moving to Manchester. I was in Manchester at this point. I'd been living there a few months. And I don't remember seeing it in the cinema. I know I did, but I have no recollection of seeing any movie in the cinema before probably the first Avengers movie.
Oh, wow.
And I know I saw them all. I definitely saw them all, because I have a friend who says we went to them all. I double checked. But
I remember seeing Thor in the cinema and the Avengers, but anything up until the Avengers I didn't watch until after I watched the Avengers.
Oh, interesting.
I wasn't interested in the backstories of Iron Man or Captain America until I saw the Avengers, and I had the least interest possible in Captain America, which conversely is weird because now he's my favourite Avenger, which I think that's interesting.
So the movie starts off with Tony Stark in Afghanistan, I believe.
I think they say Afghanistan in the film, I'm pretty sure, but I can't quite remember.
And the first part of the movie is the true origin story of not just how he becomes Iron Man, but why he becomes Iron Man. So, Anna, kick us off with your thoughts.
Well, I've got to say, rewatching this film, the first, like, 15 minutes of this movie, I think, are so awesome. Like, just really, really incredible the way they sort of build this character, all the action that happens in it, the sort of, you know, I wish I could, like, regress all the way back to, like, not knowing anything about where he goes from here, where Tony Stark goes from here. But, yeah, just, like, the real feelings of, like, jeopardy, of, like, not knowing what's going on here. And, like, the torture scenes, like, they are not fluffy. Like, it was one of those things that really struck me. Because, like, Disney wasn't at all involved in MCU or any of the movies yet. And I really felt that, like, kind of watching that first bit. And I am such a sucker for montages. I love montages.
I mean, that's good, because this movie is a whole montage.
And I think some of the best montages in actually any of the MCU movies. Absolutely love them. Those first 15 minutes just slay me. Really good.
I think that sense of jeopardy is something that I want to pick up throughout the whole thing, because I feel as we get further through the MCU, I find it harder and harder to believe that anyone's in danger.
Yeah.
Like, as we go into Infinity War, it feels like they're invincible.
Yeah.
And yeah. We'll come on to it in many, many podcast time, but in Thor Ragnarok, I feel Kate Blanchett as Hela I don't care about the ending, because I know that Thor's going to succeed.
Yeah.
Whereas in Iron Man, in that first 15 minutes, I'm like, wow, this is, something bad's going to happen. But also what I really love about the start of the film, the very first bit is that rock track on the CD player in the Jeep.
Yeah, that's great.
And I was really...
Rock track.
I can't remember.
AC/DC.
Back in Black.
But that really shocked me as the first thing you see about Marvel, because that's the tone of Marvel throughout everything. It's a bit knowing, it's a bit of a wink and a nudge. And if you look at the other big film that was out that year was The Dark Knight. That was the big film of that year.
Oh, man.
And if you contrast what DC was doing at the time with that really dark, you know, there's no laughs in those three films. It's dark, it's serious. Compared to Marvel just coming in to this world with AC/DC on, driving around a choke with Tony Stark, who's a bit of an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, I just the contrast just really struck me, and I liked how that set the tone throughout the whole MCU.
Yeah, I mean, the whole part of the movie is that Tony Stark is not just a bit of an asshole, but he's the biggest asshole on the planet, essentially. Mm. And it's really interesting, because the tone of this movie, and I'd completely forgotten, I don't know if you know which point Disney kind of came in and took over. But one thing that really got me... one thing that I was really interested about this is that sort of the villain of this movie is other humans. It's other humans doing bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Where Marvel very quickly strayed away from it being like finger-pointing at other areas of humanity that are the villains, and it's just like other superheroes and things from outer space. And the tone shift, actually, I found made this... It didn't necessarily feel as much like a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie than I thought it would have in retrospect. And there's other bits throughout the movie which it feels like they were still quite reserved in fully referencing comic books and fully referencing... self-referencing the Cinematic Universe, really. Stuff like... You know, now we see things like the Daily Bugle referred to in the movies. But in this, the news report is from Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
And it's very much, they've tried to root it in the real world. But as soon as they were given some sort of license to be even more creative with it, they've just applied themselves completely to the already established Marvel Universe, really. So it's actually... For me, one of the movies out of this list that is most rooted in the real world, and it's something that you can completely believe and see would happen in the real world.
And I quite like watching this again, because the sort of, especially that starting bit, like Tony's actions in much later films, sometimes it's kind of hard to remember that this is where he started. Like, this was his first experience of like being a superhero, and like, I mean, to be honest, the very first element of him being a superhero was to save his own skin. Like, that was his first big, powerful moment. And then it's later that he comes into realizing the strength of what he can do for other people. And then I think, like, it's a really important thing to remember when he starts acting a bit mental in later films as well.
The tone of the movie did for me already feel quite dated. It feels more in line with, like, old action movies than it does with, like, the new Marvel Cinematic Universe. There's loads of, like... And I know it's part of the theme of Tony Stark, but there's lots of America selling weapons, big explosions, you know, in the desert. And there's one bit, and I know we're going to get onto Jeff Bridges in a little bit, but there's... And honestly, I think it's one of my... I saw this, and it never registered with me before now. But there's a bit where Jeff Bridges rocks up on a Segway smoking a huge cigar and he just gets off.
Oh, it's so
and he's
good.
Like, and he's like, where is he? And I'm like, this is so...
Oh, the Segway is so good.
So American. It's unbelievable. Yeah. But it's just... It's almost... I don't think that sort of thing in this day and age would go down as well. Mm. But then it was like, look at Tony Stark and the world that he's in.
Yeah.
And the world that he's come from.
It did... So, elements of it did... Yeah, it was dated, but also it did feel like Marvel playing it a little bit safe. And to be fair, if it meant playing it safe allowed us to have all these other great films, that's good. But some bits did feel a little bit paint by numbers in terms of... This is an action film that was made in, you know, 2008. Yeah. And the other thing that I think dates incredibly badly is the misogyny.
I've got some notes about that. And
there is a certain level of it that tells a story of Tony Stark. Mm. But there was two that really stuck out to me was the air hostesses and the pole
the
coming up
pole. Oh,
from nowhere.
Yeah.
Could you even fit a retractable stripper pole on an airplane? I don't know.
I don't know.
And then the fact that...
Is that the bit that we're going to find unbelievable, aren't they? there's flying...
Collapsible stripper pole.
Flying suits and, like, military tech, but it's the collapsible,
it's the collapsible
stripper
pole. Or the fact that a Vanity Fair journalist would just sleep with Tony Stark because he did a witty one-liner.
I mean, yeah.
I just... For me, and unfortunately, this is a point that I'm going to come back to throughout this whole podcast, because I think the Marvel universe's treatment of women and people of colour and just diversity in general throughout the MCU is a really big sticking point I have with it.
Yeah.
It seemed really, really unnecessary, some of it.
I mean, I think probably the later Iron Man movies are maybe a better place to talk about Pepper Potts, because this was, I mean, she was almost, it was almost just sort of lip service in that we need Pepper Potts in there. And even though they did sort of touch on their kind of romantic underpinnings, I was glad they didn't force a love story immediately in this first movie. I mean, I completely agree. For so long, the MCU's treatment of, like, women as characters is dreadful. I mean, it was so funny to watch this movie. I can't remember the last time I saw one that so poorly failed the Bechdel test, where it's two female characters, preferably named, who talk to each other and they talk about something other than a man. And, oh man, this movie just didn't even come close.
The line where Pepper Potts says to the Vanity Fair journalist, who I can't remember the name of, is she says something like, oh, I do lots of jobs for Tony, including taking out the trash.
Yeah, it's so bad.
And I'm like, and you can advise on this because you are the woman in the room, but I can never imagine a female writer writing that line for a woman in a circumstance like that. Like, two women who've never met each other. Yeah, and maybe there's some jealousy there with Pepper, but I don't feel like we explored that enough in the film to really get Pepper being a jealous type. She seems quite intelligent, she seems quite level-headed, and for her to kind of throw that line at a woman and kind of slut-shame her just felt really off for me.
There are some definitely dated elements just sort of on the other side. Like, how cute is the mobile phone technology?
Yeah.
It's so dated. Sorry, not to immediately segue from a very important topic, but sort of just touching a bit on sort of minority representation, then what do we think of Rhodey, like, as a character and as his presence in Iron Man?
You know, I really like Rhodey, but not in this movie.
No.
Like, I don't know which one Rhodey is.
So, Terrence Howard, the
military.
The military man, best mate.
What is his job? I don't quite understand. He just comes out of nowhere all the time, and he just has, like, unlimited power.
His thing is that he's the go-between between Tony Stark and Stark Industries and selling stuff to the military.
Oh, so he's like the liaison?
Yeah, he's sort of a representative.
But still, but he's been friends with Tony for ages. Yeah,
so they graduated MIT together. You can see they wear the same ring at one point in the movie. And they're on, when it's going through Tony Stark's history at the beginning, and it's like, here's his accomplishments. They're on their graduation pictures together, I believe.
He just was quite cold. There was something not sort of appealing about him, I found. I don't know.
It feels like he didn't. It feels like he didn't want to be there throughout the movie. And he, you know, he was replaced by Iron Man 2, I think. Yeah. So, I really, really like Don Cheadle.
Do you?
And I really like him as Rhodey. But it's just, it's strange how there was no forward planning with Iron Man. Mm-hmm. It was very, the only forward planning is like the post-credits sequence.
Yeah.
And it's really weird how two or three actors from this movie change or develop into something different going forwards. And that's not really something you see in any other Marvel movies. There's lots of long contracts for actors where this...
Well, I kind of wonder if that's sort of given this movie a bit of an extra spark that I think some of the later ones don't have, because you've become a piece of a puzzle where this one was a bit of a gamble. I think they, you know, obviously they hoped it was going to be franchised, but I mean, I'm just, and that is really driven home to me in that, like, I think so many of the scenes were improvised. Like, Robert Downey Jr. was just allowed to give things multiple takes, and like, that's where so much of the humor comes from. But you're right, it does make for some inconsistencies kind of later in the film, but
less of
the series.
On the positive side, I mean, less of an inconsistency, though, is Jarvis in this movie.
Yeah.
Which really, Paul Bettany, really amazing early on as Jarvis, and actually throughout the whole of this franchise, up until Avengers Age of Ultron, becomes one of the key, one of the key characters in the whole universe.
Yeah.
I was actually reading on the trivia section of IMDb before this, that apparently he only did 2 hours work for this movie.
Oh yeah, he
never watched it, and it was very sort of, I just recorded these voice lines and then went away. And I think for him to become such a massive character in the universe and quite an adored character even before he became Vision, is a testament to how great Paul Bettany
is,
but also to how they've threaded little things throughout the whole Marvel universe that did start with this movie.
In the comics, does Jarvis become Vision? Is that the same sort of storyline?
No.
Could you have predicted this if you were a comic fan?
I don't think I meant to look this up and I completely forgot to.
I
don't think Vision did come from Jarvis. Like, he is created out of the Infinity Stone, but I don't remember what the trigger is for that.
I don't profess to know every small detail, but as far as I'm aware, Jarvis was a human character in the comic books.
Oh, yes, Edwin Jarvis. Butler. You're absolutely right,
And Vision is completely separate.
Yeah.
And he's created by Hank Pym, who we see in the Ant-Man movies.
Yes.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right, because the original Iron Man take place, I think, was it the Vietnam War that he became?
Yeah,
it became the Gulf War, and then they've sort of moved it to Afghanistan. So you're absolutely right, he was a real live Butler person.
Yeah, you're right. It's made by Ultron for use against Ultron's own creator, Dr. Hank Pym.
Okay.
Cool. And I think it's really interesting how Marvel have retooled the cinematic universe to be slightly different to the comic books, but in a way that makes it more accessible and more understandable for kind of the cinematic audience who's coming into this really fresh, because there's lots of complications with these characters throughout comic book history, but they've done a great job of just pointing fingers and going, oh yeah, Iron Man did that, not this other obscure character or this convoluted thing. They've gone, yeah, it was just Iron Man. And they've actually pinned a lot of stuff throughout this Marvel universe. Just, oh yeah, it was Iron Man. It's Tony Stark. He's got technology. That was him. And it's really interesting to see that. And I think it's really cool how they've made Tony Stark sort of the center of everything going forward.
I completely agree. I really like that he's sort of like the grounding point. And also, I mean, you see Coulson. I completely forgot that Coulson was in this movie as well. Although, dude, get a better suit. Why doesn't his suit fit him? It's such a big suit.
I don't know why, but can you get the acronym right?
Oh, I don't think I can. Strategic Homeland.
Intelligence?
No. Strategic Homeland
Intervention
and Enforcement Logistics Division.
Oh.
But once again, that's different from the comics.
Yeah.
But it's just way more easier to say out loud.
Is it?
The comic version. The comic book version is like Strategic Homeland Intervention Espionage slash.
Yeah, it's not good.
Like, it's not... It's very, very hard to say in the comic books. But interestingly enough then, going towards the end of the movie, we get another seed sown in the post-credits with Nick Fury, played by Samuel L. Jackson. And that's a complete change from the comic books and is something that's then backwards has influenced the comic books as well. Because they've kind of shoehorned Nick Fury Jr., who looks like Samuel L. Jackson, into the Marvel Universe to replace the old white guy, Nick Fury, who they've sort of retired and sent off out into space. So it's really interesting how these movies have then, clearly, they've had a massive effect on the comic book world. And a lot of the comic books have sort of been retooled to match the movies now.
Yeah.
Which has had some criticism as well, and it's not been successful in some areas, but in others it's, you know, I think it's a great way of getting more people to read comic books and get involved with the Marvel Universe.
I think so too. Let's can we talk a little bit about the end of the movie, actually? So the
got so much still to talk about at the start of the movie.
Okay. I know, there is just so much to talk about. Sorry, then you go ahead and tell.
The only thing I wanted to talk about at the very start of the film is I'd forgotten how quick it took Tony Stark to make the Iron Man suit.
Oh, yeah.
And he just... And these terrorists are in this cave surveying them
24-7
and they have no idea...
For three months.
They have no idea. Because, like, he builds a giant iron mask.
Yeah.
Like but he's doing the giveaway here?
But he's doing the leg thing. It's like, what part of a missile did they think
this
that...
this is not a missile.
Yeah.
Like,
the guy comes in and looks at the blueprints and he's like...
Which is of a man.
This checks out.
Yeah.
This is legit. He just throws him to the side.
But I'd forgotten, and I think that's meant to be, you know, Tony Stark is an ultra genius, isn't he? Like, give him, you know, the worst metal or the worst materials, and he will still build a flame-throwing super iron giant thing and escape from terrorists. And I thought that was really interesting that happened so quickly. But then I really enjoyed how long it took him to refine the suit as well.
Totally, I think
in the more recent MCU films, things just happen and people can just do stuff and you don't need a lot of montages. You know, Thor's super strong, tick. You know, you don't really get that level of time dedicated to someone refining their abilities anymore. And I really enjoyed that. It did feel a bit like, oh, he's fallen out of his suit again. Oh, he's trashed one of his cars again. But I enjoyed going on that journey with him. And it's a shame we didn't see more of that with the newer
other
films.
Ones. I completely agree. Like I said, montage sucker, but... Because, like, in the later films, the suit is so taken for granted. It just does everything. And it was really cool to be reminded about how much effort he put into it. And I like the bits, you know, where even when he then goes out into the field, as it were, he's still learning how this stuff works and he messes up a bit. I love the scene when he is flying back from having taken out it's the Ten Rings or something, isn't it? The group that's messing up the villages. And he's flying back and he's, like, trying to outmaneuver his... you know, his country's own fighter jets, and then he's on the phone with Rhodey, and he's like, it's me, I'm the one, and, you know, you get that kind of panic voice of Tony Stark that you don't ever get again. He's the Iron Man, he's in control, but this is before any of that happened, and, you know, I like that in the final action sequences as well. He's, you know, oh God, let's try flares, oh, the hydraulics will lift this car up, but I've got to lift it up more, and... Yeah, so love that.
And it felt like it was more him figuring out the suit, whereas in more recent films, he literally just goes, Jarvis, fix this problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And because Jarvis has evolved so much as well, it's kind of like he doesn't actually have to think about it. This is more kind of problem solving, and you see a bit more of his intelligence, which I enjoy.
I think also this is the only movie that that at any point Robert Downey Jr. was in some semblance of the suit. I think everything afterwards is always CGI, like kind of with the green bits on him, and they just CGI on it. But I think this is the only one where he actually had stuff on his body that
I think you can tell.
Yeah.
I think he does act a bit different when he's physically in it, which I like.
Yeah. And I think that makes sense. I can forgive the full CGI later because it would become just a part of him. He gets so used to it, and you can have a streamlined movement, but you kind of felt the weight of this and figuring it out and everything. Just sort of in relation to that, though, I figured out the one note I wrote down, which was a hand. In the final scene where he loses his glove, I get so, like, squicked out with any sort of, like, hand-related injuries. So the second his hand was, like, unprotected, I was like, oh, man, like, he would lose that hand like that in a real-life situation. But I like that, too, where he had to improvise, miss it, like, with a bit of his suit not missing, a bit of it not working. I mean, obviously, that comes again in the later films, but, yeah, this first time where he wasn't so reliant on it, he got around it quite quickly, actually. Mm. So, yeah, should we talk a little bit about Obi?
Yep.
Absolutely. Let me just say before, though, the Mark II suit, the all silver suit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The first moment where the head of that comes down and you get the full, you know, from the poster, it's Iron Man. That is my one, like, mark out moment in the movie.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, shit.
Because it kind of teases that with, like, other variants of doesn't it? And, like, when he comes out as the Iron Giant, which is the other thing, when he comes out of the cave, it's a bit like, what is this horrible thing that you've made?
Yeah.
But actually, that Silver Surfer, that reminded me of the Silver Surfer, that moment is just...
And I think as well, like, it really, for me, I was like, it really shows off that he's not just someone who can make weapons, but it's still related to this whole, like, sort of playboy aspect of him where he's like, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it with style. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But it was like an evolution of his style. Obviously, it's not purely about weapons anymore. Mm. And I really like to see, and I really hope that throughout the whole arc of the Marvel Universe, that Tony's story ends in him kind of coming away from all of it altogether. Because in this, he started up very much like war and weapons, and then he moved to like, I'm not going to sell weapons to people anymore. And he's like, this isn't a weapon. But the first thing he does with it is go use it as a weapon to fight for his cause, though.
Yeah.
And I think I he's started to do that less and less, and certainly in the later Iron Man movies, that's something that he moves completely away from. But I'd really like, and I think it'd really do a service to Tony Stark and his storyline if by the end of all this, his big thing is that he's removed completely from, you know, weapons and war and everything, and he's purely doing things to advance the human race.
Yeah.
Very in sort of an Elon Musk sort of style, do you know what I mean?
Can I just add a quick point onto your hands,
hands
thing? The moment where Pepper has to reach in to pull out the wire from his chest... I was cringing, and it still made me cry. I've seen Iron Man so many times, but that like, don't, you know, the Operation Game analogy, I was just like, bleh.
Yeah.
There's two moments where Tony Stark has long, pus-covered wires pulled out of it. There's the one from the heart, but when he's in the cave as well, he pulls that one out of his nose, and I'm like, where is that wire coming from?
But those kind of gritty kind of moments, I think we might lose in the glossiness as we're moving forward, but they're just imagine having someone else's hand pulling a wire out of your chest.
And it's deep in there as well.
Deep. And like when she talks about like the smell and the
But some great kind of green screen CGI.
It's not. It's a fake chest.
Really?
Yeah. So what they did was they built like this kind of fake looking chest over it, and then his neck is in it.
So he's kind of like leaning in.
So So he's actually. I think it's like he's sort of sat behind it, and then so it's just a chest that she actually could interact with and reach into.
Wow.
So
I thought it was so seamless.
Yeah, it looked really great.
It was fair, but
so gross.
It was horrible. It was gross.
That's interesting about those sort of darker beats they're not darker because like that one was played to comedic effect, but things that are a bit more like that weapon that Obadiah uses to paralyze him. Like the way his face changes, the obvious pain, like those sort of quieter, violent moments. Mm. I think they do. You do lose those sort of as the films progress.
And that blue kind of electricity stuff, it reminded me of Black Widow's weapons. You know, she's got this kind of blue. She's got the blue sticks, and then in one film, she's got a suit that's kind of got that blue vein through it. I thought that was interesting that could be the same technology that she uses in the future.
Yeah. Well, again, sort of like going back to that, the sort of how it defined a lot of the visual style. Like, I bet there was a lot of discussion about, or maybe there wasn't, considering it was the first one. But like the tone of blue that was used to sort of signify this energy, the heads up display. And yeah, you're absolutely right. That sort of gets carried through sort of the other, and I guess it makes sense since, like Dan said, a lot of it would be coming from Tony. Like he's the inventor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever you find these plot holes or little things that you're like, oh, I wonder where that came from in the movie. Anyone online is just like, oh yeah, Tony's
done it. Tony took care of it.
It's really easy. I'm a big fan of this movie. Mm. I think it's solid entry to the Marvel Universe. I think you can completely see how they've changed from this style to what I would call like the Marvel formula for movies now. But it set the seeds for a lot of things, and I think I'm a really big fan of it retrospectively, but I wouldn't necessarily go back and watch it loads. I'd maybe watch the montage bits and then stop watching it by the final bit of the movie where you've got Obadiah Stane making his own Iron Man. It's just all very...
Do we want to talk about that kind of crescendo of the film?
I mean, I don't know if we have anything to say that probably most people don't. Or I mean, I had totally forgotten that was Jeff Bridges before I saw the movie again. His character is so... I've got so many villain rants prepared that I can do later. And this is the thing, like, what I like about this movie up until the final act is this idea that, like, Marvel is at its best when it's focusing on its characters. There's no MacGuffin, there's no, like, villain's cockamamie plan, like, driving the plot forward. It's like, character is plot. Like, characters drive the plot forward. And I feel up until the final act, they did that. And it's not like, let's go get the thing. It's, oh, how would this person react to it? And even Obadiah, up until a certain point, like, oh my god, the part where he's fighting Tony in the street and he's talking about, like, how he's gonna run the company. It's like, mate, like, it's it's over. Like, you blew it. Like, everyone, and god, his, I would love to know how Jeff Bridges kind of came up with that voice. Tony! It's so funny. It's so funny.
But look, despite the flaws in the villain, we'll probably talk about villains loads in this, but I prefer villains that are grounded in reality.
Oh, 100%.
I like when it feels like it could happen. Yeah. That sounds really stupid, but when... How can I explain this? I don't necessarily like a big orb in the sky that is destroying a major American city, or a Russian city, or whatever. You know, a lot of superheroes films for me, it turn me off when something big in the sky is either pulling things up into it or things are falling out of it. I prefer villains where it's like a hand on hand, me and you. Combat, I think, and that's why I liked this bit in Iron Man. Yeah.
The only thing that I took away from the end of the movie is that there's one of the, and I actually, with Pepper Potts, with Gwyneth Paltrow in this movie, I actually wrestle with her throughout the whole series, because on some areas I'm like, you're really cool, you fit the character really well. Mm. On other bits, I'm like, I just, her acting actually falls really short for me, and there's just one bit in this movie where every time I see it, I'm like, you didn't know what's going on there. And it's at the end with the Section 16 door, and she's leading the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, and it's like, you know, Obadiah Stane's got this big thing, they don't know about it yet, but they know something's going to happen, and they're like going to arrest him, and they all walk in there really seriously, and she just goes up to the door and she's like, boop. And then she pauses, boop. But then she pauses again and just goes, it's not working. I'm like, you wouldn't do that. You'd be like frantically like pressing it, or you know, you wouldn't do this really defined motion. And for me, it was just like, that felt it's one of those moments. It's probably not bad acting, it's probably just dating of technology, that now if you've got like a pass or something, yeah, that you just kind of roughly hold it up against and like, this way everyone. But instead she's very like precise with the movement, and I just can't see it without going.
And it did, when she was just in amongst all the firefight, it did remind me of that bit in Jurassic World where the female protagonist is running away from the T-Rex, but she's still doing it in heels.
Yeah.
Like it just it's like, what? There's so much grounding in reality in this Iron Man film, but then Pepper Potts is in this major fight with like giant advanced machinery and just doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't get
at the end. Like Tony's like, do this to the arc reactor, and she's like twisting the knobs, and suddenly she's like, I'm in charge of this whole dashboard of things.
Yeah, I do appreciate that he couldn't have defeated Obadiah without her. Like, he simply couldn't have done it on his own.
Yeah, I get that she's very, very capable and very intelligent, but I don't think her character was developed as much to make those scenes believable. Like you said, that she can't open a door.
I think you go one way or the other, you support it and be like, she's really smart, really tuned, and it'd have been great to see that, and you do see that more in later movies with her, but it'd be great from the off to see that actually she plays a role similar to how she's portrayed in some comic books, where it's like she's kind of the brains, Tony's just the science guy, but she's the one controlling his life. And not controlling, you know, organising, arranging his life. And actually, we do see in this movie that he would be completely helpless without her.
Yeah.
But I think it could have been taken to the next level, really. And I think we do start to get there with Iron Man 3 especially.
Yeah.
But it'd have just been great to see it from the off without those weird inconsistencies about how she can't use a key card.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Totally. Although I've got to say, the third act really falls down for me, but I can forgive a lot for the very final line where he says, "I am Iron Man." That is awesome, and it definitely touches on something that I love about the Marvel Universe, at least like this iteration of it, is that there aren't any secret identities. You can do something, be someone. I mean,
apart from perhaps Black Widow and Hawkeye,
who
struggle with that.
That's true.
Later on.
Would anyone be interested in Hawkeye's real identity? Sorry, I know we'll talk about Hawkeye later.
Paul Klein.
I feel like I'm going to have to cheerlead for Hawkeye.
I think I'm going to have a lot of fun ribbing you about Hawkeye throughout this.
I think he's great.
I think he's great.
Purple is a poor choice. Does he wear purple?
It's not like a dark mauve.
It's more of a mauve.
He's bright purple in comic books. So I always feel that if he wasn't purple, he'd get a lot more credibility. Mm.
Yeah.
It's just an odd colour choice. So, knowing the secret identities, would you send Iron Man a piece of fan mail in the real world?
Oh, yeah.
If he did that interview and got it, would you be like, Tony Stark, you're great. Thank you for being Iron Man. Do you think that he served the world in any sort of way in this movie?
No.
I'd be like, here is the amount of money that you need to pay me because you lifted up my car or you damaged my village.
Apparently, so the Audi R8 features quite prominently in this movie. Apparently, he was meant to throw it at Obadiah Stane or something in the final bit, or drive it into him and knock him over, and then like punch through the roof of the car and like rip it apart and appear out of it and be like, you're screwed, Obadiah. But they couldn't get the car to do it right, so they couldn't get the car to flip. But I thought it's really interesting, the amount of public damage. I mean, this isn't...
But that's going to come up a lot.
Yeah, it's not exclusive to this movie, but I'd love to know the total cost of all the public damage.
I think there's somewhere that's calculated. We should definitely find out.
It's an insane amount, and I think it's trivialised a little bit in this movie.
Yeah.
And I think it's trivialised a little bit in all superhero movies.
And also, I would never invite Tony Stark to an event, because one of two things are going to happen.
Yeah.
He's going to have a major showdown with a villain or an enemy, or he's just not going to show up.
Yeah.
I was just like, you've got an assistant who can decline invitations for you if you don't want to go. Just user.
What, did he not show up to? Did he not show up to?
The very beginning at the award.
They're having a whole event to mark him at this great
award. To be fair, I think he was there, because he was gambling, wasn't he? And he just didn't go to the podium or something like that.
Rhodey brings him his award, doesn't he? Like, he was just,
poor Rhodey.
There's no excuse for not being polite.
Great. So, we're not going to do a rating.
No.
We're going to do a kind of wrap-up at the end of each phase.
Yeah.
But Iron Man, does it stay or does it go?
Stays, 100%.
Stays if I can take out the pole dancing flight attendants.
Just the pole dancing?
Just that.
Do you think if that was gone, that'd make up for a lot of the other shit in the movie?
No, but that's a bit of sexism. I like the least.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh man, I'd really forgotten about that. That is so bad.
I think if they remade it now, they'd find a way to make him a scumbag in a different way.
Yeah.
I think there's other ways that you can show that he was a playboy.
Or the gambling. They could amp up the gambling.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's other way that you can show that he's got that sort of lifestyle.
Mm.
I mean, having Stan Lee as Hugh Hefner was enough. We get it. We get it. You know what I mean? You have a playboy lifestyle, Tony Stark. You don't need a stripper pole, flight attendant, party in the sky.
Yeah, definitely.
But for me, it stays. It's probably like the quintessential early Marvel movie.
Agreed.
You know, it does better than the other ones around it, I think, for me, in terms of sowing the seeds of the Marvel Universe. And it just, the montage moments, as much as they do feel tired throughout the film, and it feels like the film is one big montage, they're great.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're undisputed, some of the best montages in film ever. So for me, it absolutely stays, and I'll probably watch it again.
Over two nights, because you fall asleep.
Yeah, over two nights. So,
what's next?
So next up, next week, we will be discussing the big green monster, the Incredible Hulk, but the Edward Norton Incredible Hulk.
Which I've never seen. I've never seen this film.
Have you never seen it at all?
No.
Interesting.
Absolutely never seen it.
This is the first time for you.
Are there any pole dancing flight attendants?
Not that I remember. Okay. My tone of this movie is the majority of it is in darkness.
Yeah, I remember having just a hard time watching it. Just what is happening?
Like, physically.
I'm going to go into it with an open mind.
Me too.
I'm going to completely imagine that it's the same actor playing the Hulk as in the other movies.
Mm. Yeah.
And that it's the same Hulk that I've grown to kind of, I really loved him, and then now I dislike him again. But we'll get onto that in 17 movies time.
I can't wait to talk about Matt Ruffalo as well.
Excellent.
And how he is incredibly beautiful.
Awesome. Can't wait for that conversation too.
So Anna, where can people follow you on the internet?
So I am on Instagram at Anna2NsMarvelous with two L's.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as Martin Loves.
And you can find me on Instagram or on Twitter at DVNPreston.
I have one more important question. Should you guys not cut your beards till we see Infinity Wars?
Can I trim the sides?
I trim my beard twice a week, so that is a big ask to make.
I think it'd be amazing.
Looking at the dates on this sheet, I would be a very, very hairy man. And I cannot commit to that.
Okay.
As long as I can neaten up the sideburns, I'm happy. Because my plan was to grow this till May anyway.
So. I'll stop trimming my beard when there's a female lead in a Marvel film.
You'll stop trimming your beard. So you're saying that when there's a female lead,
when Miss Marvel is that's coming out, isn't it?
Yeah.
Miss Marvel is 2019, I think.
I'm going to be very hairy in 2019.
Awesome.
Great. Well, Paul, thank you very much, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.
We'll see you, speak to you again next time on The Marvelous Lunch Break.
Da-da-da.